a better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Halloween, October 31st, 2024. And because it is a Thursday, it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. And it worked out the way I really like my last show of the week before we do a flashback to end at a 0 or a 5. I don't know why. I just like numeric patterns. And this is episode 3580 of the Survival Podcast. And for Halloween, I got no real Halloween topics, but I do have a monster lineup from the expert council. Dan McAdams and Ron Paul will acknowledge that Elon Musk is right. Government spending itself is a tax, because somebody's got to pay it, and sure as hell ain't going to be them. And the initial estimate is we can cut $2 trillion for government spending, and we'll hear about that from Dan and Dr. Paul. And then we're going to talk about chemical fitness with Andy McCann, and also how sometimes it doesn't mean what you think it means. Kerry Brown will talk about foraging wild greens in the fall, because we are in the fall. Jeff Lawton will talk about dealing with a whole bunch of a plant called St. John's wort that's actually a really valuable nutraceutical plant, but it may not be what you want on your pasture if you're trying to raise livestock. So Jeff will talk about various solutions to that issue. Nicole Sauce will talk about setting pricing on your product when your labor is the only labor, but you don't really plan for it to stay that way. Sean Mills will talk about evaluating an off-grid solar power system when you're buying a house that already has one, and adapting to what maybe you want that's beyond what the existing homeowner wanted when they put theirs in, or maybe you have a better budget than they do. Who knows? And then we're going to talk, my anchor segment, about making very large brush piles into biochar, and I'm going to acknowledge the logistical issues that come with doing that. Generally, when we talk about brush piles, usually they're pushed together, large tangled masses. A lot of times it involved a heavy equipment being used, either a backhoe or a bobcat or an excavator or something. It's just kind of this big jumble of crap. And in the words of Ben Falk, when he's talking about dealing with trees and you're cutting firewood or whatever, you know, bolewood's easy, but the slash is a pain in the ass. And usually there's a lot of slash in a brush pile, but it's worse than just slash. A lot of times it's like the trunks are all cracked and bent and twisted, and it's just a pain in the ass. And because of that, it's difficult to deal with. And so what most people do is they just set them on fire. They push them into an area where they won't burn other things down. You wait for the appropriate time, and you set up how you burn it to ash, and you get rid of it. And there's a place for that. I'll even acknowledge that when we talk about it. But we're going to talk about some various approaches when you're dealing with this type of waste stream if you do want to kind of do right by Mother Nature and make biochar out of it. So that'll be what my segment's about today. With that in mind, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams on how government spending is a tax, and can we cut it by $2 trillion? Hell, I think we can do better.
But there was this fella called Elon Musk. He thought that maybe we could cut some money. And he knows about a lot of money, so maybe a trillion here, a trillion there isn't that much.
Yeah.
So, but is it true that he was giving a speech in public?
Yeah.
He said something about cutting?
Yeah.
$2 trillion?
Well, let's take a look at
it. Was he drinking?
I don't know. I don't know what he was up to, but why don't we listen now? He was at a Trump rally, and you might want to grab your earpiece and listen, because he was at a Trump rally recently, and he was talking about cutting the budget, something you don't hear very often. Let's listen in.
How much do you think we can rip out of this wasted $6.5 trillion Harris Biden budget?
Well, I think we could do at least $2 trillion.
Yeah.
Yes.
$2 trillion.
I mean, at the end of the day, you're being taxed. You're being taxed. All government spending is taxation. So whether it's direct taxation or all government spending, it's either becomes inflation or it's direct taxation. Your money is being wasted and the Department of Government Efficiency is going to fix that.
I've mentioned that quite a few times, and I think that's so important that when you spend, it's a tax.
Yeah.
Because if one way or another, they're either going to have an income tax or some other type of tax, or they're going to print money, and then it's a tax, it's an inflation tax. And the one other thing that you can depend on is it's not the rich that will end up paying those $2 trillion. It's going to be the middle class. But what impresses me is... he said that in public,
yeah.
You know, and he didn't get hauled off the stage.
Yeah.
I guess there were a few people who would like to do that, but...
Yeah, and also, you know, the trick that they do on the Hill is they reduce the level of increase and call it a cut.
Right.
It's not a cut.
Budgeting.
Like, yeah, I mean, inflation as a tax, that's great. Well, you were impressed by what he said yesterday, and you went on to Twitter. Let's show this tweet that you put out when you listened to Elon... talk about cutting money. You said Elon cutting $2 trillion from the budget. Great idea. Start with some of the biggest welfare recipients: military industrial complex, pharmaceutical industrial complex. Oh, and end the Fed. And to our surprise, Elon answered, "Do the next one." And I liked his response. He said, "Needs to be done." You can see it right there under the photo. That was a response to your suggestion.
But I have a question. Did anybody read this? Did anybody pay any attention?
Well, about 1 million people saw it.
Oh, thank goodness for Trump and Musk.
Yeah. So I'm not looking to be a Debbie Downer here or crap on anybody's parade. I really do think it is highly likely that Orange Man 2.0 is going to happen. I do think at this point that people like Elon Musk, Tulsi Gabbard, RFK Jr. have got to actually be part of his administration. Bobby Kennedy came out yesterday and pretty much dropped the whole squirrel out of the bag and said, Trump has promised me to put me over HHS to basically make him Secretary of Health and Human Services. Now, there could be some issues getting him through Congress with that, but, we've done things like that before and figured out how to get people in positions if the Congress doesn't want to play along. So I think all this will occur as far as these people being involved and at a meaningful level. An RFK over HHS could be so much turmoil, and it could be so worth Orange Man just for that alone. And by the way, let me say, I think that Trump's campaign, whether it's him directly or not, made a masterful move in pulling RFK into his campaign and giving him that isolated area of power where he will do the most good. I can't fault it because... it's my concept. It's what I said I would do. Like Bobby Kennedy, do you want him as president? No. I don't want him touching money. I don't want him touching energy. Environmental, sure, but not energy, right? And how do you separate that? I'm like, put him over HHS, and then he'd take his best qualities and do something. So I think this is true. And if you want monetary efficiency, Elon Musk. And if you want get shit done, also Elon Musk. Because Elon is very monetarily efficient. But let me tell you, and I know this firsthand from people that work directly with Elon on major projects. He also doesn't understand no. This is actually what's made him a success. He doesn't understand no. No doesn't mean anything to him. We need this. We can't do it. It doesn't make any sense to him. His response is, okay, well, how much money does it take? So not only is he efficient with money, he's also willing to spend it when the thing needs doing. Okay? Here's the problem I see in this, though, because he is good at monetary efficiency, and he probably will find $2 trillion or more to cut. One, we got to get that through Congress in some levels and what have you. But more, I wonder how this is going to play with Trump. Now, the only upside to this is Trump will never stand election again if he wins this time. Like, did Trump 1.0, 2.0, and done, right? We have a term limit on the president. No matter what the left says, he's not going to be a dictator for life and stay in office for life and send SEAL Team 6 after your mom or what other bullshit they come up with. But Trump likes buying votes. I just listened to Trump talk to people in Wisconsin about this wonderful contract for, like, $50 billion to build frigate ships for the Navy. And he kept saying to the crowd, don't forget, I gave you that. I gave you that. I gave you that. So if you're going to cut all this money, there's going to be a lot less spending that can be used to buy loyalty from governors, states, senators, etc. So I just think it'll be interesting to watch that collide and see, like, will Trump match his mouth with this idea of reducing spending. Because, bluntly, there's plenty of spending to reduce, and much of it likely could be reduced by, you know, getting people that are, you know, congressmen's, you know, brother-in-laws and shit to stop being awarded, like, no-bid contracts or what I call fake bid contracts. What they'll actually do is they'll get multiple bids, but two of them are never, they're going to take three bids and two of them are never going to happen no matter what the number is, one way or another. And they'll even do things, like I've dealt with governmental bids, and if they don't want you, they literally will do things that make you think you need to bid higher than you do to force your bid higher. That way they can give the contract to the person that they want. Not all contracts that are awarded from the government, contrary to your popular belief, are awarded to the lowest bidder. There's a combination of factors. And if the discrepancy is not that much, 5, 10%, but there's a genuine belief that this other party is going to do a better job, be less likely to fail, etc., then there's no problem taking them in most of these bids. So it'll just be interesting to watch all this. I have to say, the Ass Clown Circus 2024 is one for the record books. There has been never been better memes, better talking points, more humor. And what I have to say, I got to give credit to the Trump crowd. What I love about the Trump crowd this year, they have taken everything that's been thrown at them as an insult, no matter how disgusting the insult is, whether it's being called Nazis or fascists or garbage or, you know, go all the way back to 2016 deplorables and all the other things and weird and whatever. And all they've done is twisted it and made it funny and thrown it right back at the left. And I gotta respect that. Anyway, moving on. Let's talk about chemical fitness, and I'll have some follow up on this one as well with Andy McCann.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann out here in Woodstock, Georgia, and I host a podcast called Fitness, Food, and Finances. You can find me on any podcast app as well as YouTube. Actually, there it's just at AndyMcCann42. But my goal is to help you live that long, good life and lay a great foundation for your future. Anyway, I got a question from Jeff from Georgia, and we met up there at the Self-Reliance Festival, so that was awesome. Great to meet you. So his first question is, how did you do that thumb magic trick? So I'm not going to tell you how I did that, but if you guys go to Jack's in November, then I will redo it there, and you can see and try to figure it out. Okay, so the real question was, he said, John said he uses chemicals to stay fit. Where do you fall on that? So we did have a conversation about that, and here's what I'm going to say. I think I've said this before in a past podcast, but I am a fan of you doing whatever you need to do to meet your goals, especially if it doesn't affect anyone else negatively. I mean, you're an adult. Do whatever you want. But here's the thing I think that you might, or we as a group might have missed, or maybe, Jeff, you're asking me to really like lay this out for everybody. If you met John or listened to any of his talking points, you're going to understand that he is dedicated and he is doing the work, not just maintaining. So he said, yes, I'm using some cocktails, hormones, etc., to help me keep what I've got. Now, understand that. He's keeping what he has. And he said, I'm in maintenance mode. So his maintenance mode is pretty damn awesome. My maintenance mode is not as nearly as awesome looking as his. So there is that. He's already got what he wanted, and he's doing some things to keep it. And it is true, as you get older, some of this stuff doesn't want to stay, and so you have to work at keeping it. So I've got some options here. And Jack, please help me with this. I know they were at Self-Reliance Festival, and I know you've mentioned them before, and I tried to look for them. There's somebody that does a blood panel that you guys use. I would recommend that. Do a comprehensive blood panel, hormones, everything, and let a professional tell you what you're missing and go start from there. But here's the thing with John. He says, I'm in maintenance mode. But yet in his talk, he's like, I am always active. I sleep maybe 4 hours a night, and I'm always doing stuff. So he's always moving. You can tell by his midline that he's not just sitting around eating. He's on his feet moving all day. He's on his property and doing stuff that, you know, needs to get done, but he's always moving. He also has a gym in the back of the facility, so anybody that's there can work out anytime. So it's not like his maintenance mode. So you have to understand the words. Maintenance mode does not mean he's just coasting to the end. That is not it. Now, it is possible you could do that and have some lingering effects, but look at like Arnold Schwarzenegger or Lou Ferrigno. If you coast to the end, man, it may not look that great. If you look at those two, they're still doing stuff, and they look pretty good in their 70s or maybe 75, 80s, whatever they're in. But His maintenance mode is more than what most of us do in active mode, so you have to realize that. He has a gym in the back, and he is, you know, always busy and super consistent. So he has a routine, and he's getting it done. All right, that being said, am I in favor of it? Yeah. For everybody? No. I think you need to put in the work in order to get there. So if you, like the Ozempic stuff that's out there, or those, whatever the category of drugs are called, there are so many side effects inside of that they're still not really sure, or even the ones that they are sure of, that I'm not a fan of just going straight to that. The other reason is that you haven't done any of the work to earn at least some of it. So basically, you're not changing your habits and who you are, and you really got to dial down into that habit loop and figure out what's causing you to be the way you are, and how do you undo that? So for the vast majority of us, I'm going to say no, I'm not a fan, but I am a fan. I mean, totally, go ahead and do what you want to do if that's what you want to do, but understand your goals and understand what everybody else is saying. His maintenance mode is your very active mode. Okay, so once you get yourself set up with a doctor and you take your test, and actually a lot of these things you can just mail in. You know, sometimes you can go to like Quest Lab or any lab or whatever, but other ones you can like put blood on a card and send it off. I'm not really sure how all that works, but anyway, there are a lot of ways to do this. You probably have to go in to get the super comprehensive one, but you want to hire someone's brain. Anybody can draw the blood and anybody can spin it and tell you what's like, okay, here's your report. I just printed it off. But not everybody is going to give you great advice. So make sure you find somebody that's going to give you great advice. And I would use the one that Self-Reliance Festival had there. They had somebody with the panel. And, man, I might have actually saved that card. Well, I should have gotten that beforehand. That being said, do the work first. Yes, it's an aid. And, yes, it can help replace the things that you're missing. And that's great. But if you're not going to do any of the work, then I don't know. It's like you're just going to end up where you were before. So don't just get the shot. Change who you are so you don't become that person again. I can tell you how many times I've seen people bounce back. It's almost like 99%. People lose a bunch of weight and they bounce right back into lots of weight. Or they start working out and they fall off the wagon. They go back to not working out. It's most of us. You really have to dial in. I think probably the bigger one is you have to have a reason to do this. I think a good one is this prepping environment. Yes, I have my preps. I have my bullets, band-aids, and beans, but I also have the ability to, like, do. And I'm not the weak link. I don't know. I think that's good motivation. Okay, so, Jeff, you asked. I am on board. I think it's totally fine. But I would say, one, do all the panels, and two, do the work first. Don't let the shots just do the stuff. But also, the last thing is, John's maintenance mode is totally kicking ass, and it's way more than our regular mode. So there's that. All right, y'all take care.
So, like, just to make sure that's all clear, like, John's not using Ozempic or any GLP-1 that I know of, and I don't know what other enhancements he's using. The one thing I absolutely know that John uses, I guess you could call it chemical fitness, but I don't, because I think adding more of what's already in your body is like hormone therapy. I don't consider it chemical. And so the one thing I do know that John does, and I know quite a few people that do this, especially at his age, which he's about my age, he's in his 50s, is he uses supplemental testosterone. And I think that actually might be a gateway to, I want to say living longer, but living longer with quality of life specifically for men. The men that I've talked to that do this, and so I've talked to men who basically didn't really need it, but as they got into that older cycle of their life, they use it so that they can keep training the way they have their whole life. I also have a very good friend, I mean a very close friend, who dealt with low testosterone levels his whole life. And this is a good dude, right? This is not like a soy boy or something. But this guy could, and I mean he tried. This dude could never put muscle mass on, I mean at all. And he is day and night physically different from when I met him about 12 years ago. Day and night. So I don't know that I would call that chem fitness, but I completely agree with Andy's overriding viewpoint here that if you're going to use enhancements, you should be enhancing something, not trying to be a couch potato that thinks you're going to be slim and trim and look good because you take a couple different pills. And I also think that we have only begun to scratch the surface on what maybe can be done to enhance both longevity and quality of life in that longevity. There's certainly some medications out of the diabetic space that I think are poison for everybody, especially when it goes into type 2 diabetics like GLP-1s. My sister-in-law did two doses of a GLP-1 and has destroyed herself. just from two doses. She hasn't taken another one in almost a year, and she's still dealing with the fallout from it. I wouldn't get near one of those. But there is a drug that some diabetics use called metformin. And metformin has been used in studies on rodents, albeit they are rodents. But, you know, these are rodents that are bred to be as close to human in response as possible. They're not the little mouse that you get down to feed your snake at the pet store. And they have definitely shown longevity enhancement using metformin. Am I saying go out and start taking a bunch of metformin? No. I am saying that, like, and Joe Rogan's covered this, there are certain molecules that may be able to be used to create greater longevity. Now, the number one molecule I think that we could use to enhance longevity is two of them. It's protein and fat from animals. And I think that an animal-based diet will go a long way, because if you want to look at somebody that looks amazing, and I bet you he's not taking artificial testosterone, I'm going to give you two, and they both could write them prescriptions. One is Doc Berry, right? Ken Berry, I don't think he's using any enhancements whatsoever, and he looks great, but he's big because he's a big dude, right? The guy's like, when I first met him in real life, I'm like, I had no idea you were this big. I'm standing there looking at his nipples. Right, not because I think they're cool, because that's where my eyes are at. Like, he's a tall man. He's a big man. But he's not buff the way the next guy I'm going to talk about is. Dr. Sean Baker. If you've never checked this guy out, I follow him on TikTok and on X. Love the dude. He's like Ken Berry 2.0, right? I mean, really. But he is like, this dude's like the seventh ranked rower in the world, and he's 57 years old. I don't know if you've ever done it, like on rowing machines where they all network together and you can compete with each other across the country. He's number seven in the country. I don't know if you've ever done real rowing on a rowing machine, not some little piece of shit with some pistons, but the recoil ones. There's nothing I've ever done in my life that has put me closer to falling on the ground than that. I think the only thing that ever that just tapped me more, you know, from an energy standpoint than a rowing machine was a bayonet course in the military. Like, that is, you hit the end of that thing and you just fall. My dad and I used to work out together when I was a teenager. He described a rowing machine as shoveling rice coal or buckwheat coal with a number 10 coal shovel nonstop. And if you've ever done that, you know what I'm saying. So, like, that dude is buff as shit and cardio as fuck. And he's not using anything. The difference between those two guys and John Willis. John Willis likes candy, right? Like, so I think John has to work harder for the result, because John is fucking built, bro. John is built as shit, especially at his age. But I don't have any problem with people bringing in things like supplemental hormones, and I don't necessarily think if they're done right that they're necessarily chemical fitness. And I think if you can extend your life and quality of life, it's something worth at least considering. That's just my thoughts. Moving on, let's talk about winter greens, not winter green, but foraging greens, wild greens, and not really winter. I don't know why I put that in there. It's really fall. It's fall right now, isn't it? Carrie Brown wants to talk to us about fall greens.
Hey, TSP community. Carrie Brown here from Strong Roots Resources. And well, guys, just like that, it's the middle of October. I've already had my first fire of the season, and now that it's cooled down, we're going to enjoy a reemergence of a few wild greens. I was out scouting our property yesterday and came up with a nice little list of what you guys can also look out for. First of all, we've got the dandelion. I know we all want to talk about the dandelion, but really, I think it's tastier this time of year than it is in the spring. Maybe I get to it a little too late in the springtime, but it is tender, it is flavorful, it is not bitter. So whether you want to go ahead and harvest some greens, or if you just want to mark them so you can dig up your tubers later, lots of medicinal uses for those tubers. Don't overlook the modest dandelion. The sheep sorrel has also made its secondary run. This sheep sorrel likes to grow where I have previously had compost piles, so that bottom soil was pretty nice, according to the sheep sorrel, and it readily reseeds itself, so I have a couple of different patches that I can pretty frequently pick from, whether we use it or I pick it for the rabbits as well. Sheep sorrel is pretty lemony, packs a punch. So if you're looking for kind of that citrus profile to add to a meal, it's a good option. The ox-eye daisy is also hanging out in the garden. It also has a pretty robust and peppery flavor this time of year, but make sure that you're not confusing it with fleabane daisy. Right now, the fleabane up here is flowering, and the ox-eye is only in its rosette state. So, get you a couple of guides and double-check that one, because fleabane leaves are really not edible. The cresses, including watercress, have bounced back after their round of flowering in the summertime, and that's another spicy addition to your meals. Wintercress is one that I can reliably forage literally right outside my back door through most of the winter. We have creeks nearby, and I can get to the watercress if I want it, but literally outside my kitchen, we have patches of wintercress that that just kind of hang out all winter long. They are also called creasy greens in some regions. That's kind of definitely an Appalachian thing. So keep an eye out for those. Field mustard, that is also popping up in our lower pasture. If you need to clear your sinuses out, field mustard is the way to go. This field mustard we have here, it is as powerful as horseradish. And both of those, the cresses and the field mustard, I like to chop up and add to like a stew that's got a spicy sausage, Italian sausage style. Really, really good stuff. While most of the perilla has gone to seed, if it's in a spot where it gets mowed back a couple of times, those leaves are still able to be harvested. If they've gone to seed, they're really not too good at that point. The flavor profile is just kind of off, but if they're still in leaf and you don't mind kind of a licorice-style flavor, perilla is pretty good. That's also known as shizo if you are picking it up from the from your Asian grocery stores. I like to throw it in stir-fries, soups, things of that nature. And in addition to the perilla, kind of growing side-by-side down here, are lamb's quarters, which, especially in the shadier locations, and if it's been set back by mowing and hasn't set seed yet, those greens, those leaves, are kind of like a spinach, in my opinion, and continue to stay tender and flavorful when a lot of other stuff is beyond that point. When we do our oddball Tennessee transition from scorching hot to 34 degrees within 3 days, which is what happened here. So if you'd like to learn more about the wild, medicinal, edible, and otherwise useful species on your land, I do offer in-person property walks, foraging classes, consulting, and education, as well as identification and documentation of those species on your property. Feel free to reach out to me at strongrootsresources@gmail.com, and y'all have a great week.
On lamb's quarters, he mentioned setback by mowing. I'll just let you know, if you have lamb's quarters on your property, and you don't wipe it out every year, and you want some later in the season, you can basically do that intentionally, and I will. I'll usually select a couple plants, and I'll prune them very aggressively. And when you prune them, they re-sprout, and if you, like you said, never let it go to seed, that regrowth is as tender as the young growth early in the year. And lamb's quarters is one of my absolute favorite greens. And the way I like to use lamb's quarters is either little leaves in a nice salad, like, because they kind of dress it up and they look cool and they taste great, or wilted into soups at the end of a soup, or wilted into something that might benefit from some greens wilted into it, like treat it like spinach. Anyway, moving on, let's hear about another plant. This one actually a very useful nutraceutical, but it may be in a place you don't want it, but maybe you can use it for its economic value as you transition, or maybe you can just figure out how to use it for its nutritional value, or and its monetary value, by the way, or maybe you need to get rid of it. What do you say? Jeff Lawton, probably the most switched on permaculture mind out there, got a pasture, Jeff. It's full of St. John's wort. What do you have to say on it?
Hi, Jeff Lawton here, coming to you from Jordan in the Middle East, where I'm working on the Green in the Desert project. I have a question here about St. John's wort and how to mitigate it on a future cow pasture where it's taken over. And what's the permaculture? The problem is the solution type approach. Well, the first thing that I would do is I'd look into St. John's wort as a product. If you look it up online and research it, it's used as an antidepressant, and there's $210 million demand for it in the United States every year. Worldwide, there's $534 million demand. So it's actually quite a valuable product. You might look at making it a little bit more of a financial return to subsidize the establishment of your cattle pasture. But if you don't want to do that, then the problem and the solution here is to compost it. If it's a rocky pasture and you can't get it all out and pick it up with a forage harvester, you'd have to find a way to get it out in amongst the rocks. But it's essentially the main component of a compost that you need to create stimulate the pasture. So it would be the green material, and you'd need to use it fresh. Then you'd have to use bran material like wood chip or sawdust, and you'd have to use manure. So at least a third manure, a third brown, slow to break down material like fine wood chip or fine sawdust or dry leaves, one third green material. And the large amount of that, if that's St. John's wort, if you take that through a compost of at least 30 days to 50 days, 35 days gives you a turn every week for 5 weeks. And then you could go, if you don't get it right, up to 10 weeks, which is 50 days. 70 days, should I say. But anyway, you'd have to learn a little bit about composting to make sure you get this inoculum compost with St. John's wort as the main component. And it needs to have a large population of beneficial microorganisms. So you need to understand things like the soil food web type of teachings. Matt Powers, a student of mine, does a lot of things about understanding how to use a microscope to see quality compost, which is got a lot of microorganisms, beneficial soil microorganisms in it, and a large diversity. That's the key, like most things. Large population and a large diversity in the finished compost. Now, you can then go across the pasture and slash it, cut it. If you can't because it's rocky, you'll have to overgraze it at the right time. But the idea is to cut down and stress the St. John's wort, and then go over with an aerator, which is a drum, a tow machine behind a tractor with kind of like daggers, not quite spikes. They're a little bit more like blades. You can get a double drum version, and it'll offset, so it'll slightly rip, but it doesn't matter. If you've got a single drum, it's okay. It's a bought product. You can buy them in America. You can buy them in Australia. They're quite popular. It's a decompaction machine. It just spikes the ground with like daggers on a drum. And you can put a seed boxes onto it and seed straight into the little cuts and rips. And you want to put in a diversity of beneficial pasture seed. But you can also put a dripper on it and drip compost tea straight into the rip lines. So that means making an oxygenated compost tea, and that'll get it in there directly. Now, you can make that if you learn how to do it. You've got to put it on within 6 to 8 hours because it's actually alive. You're inoculating the soil with the beneficial organisms. Or you could get someone local to make it for you, come out to site if it's remote, make it, and then put it on. It saves the volume and is easy to apply as a liquid. Now, you could put on compost, but you need to put quite a lot on if it's solid compost. You can actually put that out onto the drip lines. All of this you need to be doing late in the afternoon, ideally just before rain or irrigation. Now, if you're remote, you can't irrigate. You're going to have to time it because it's a transformational event for that pasture to come out of the St. John's Wort situation, which means it's actually got a weed in position that is fulfilling an empty niche of damage on the pasture. So you want to fast track it out of that niche, instead of allowing it to grow and die, grow and die, grow and die, grow and die, and gradually move into a more sustainable ongoing ecosystem development. You want to favour it towards cows, but the problem is you can easily damage it with cows without cell grazing correctly or moving the animals in the right rotations with the right density. That's where you can make things change. Ideally, there's trees through the pasture on contour lines, at least trees every 300 feet. On contour is best, so you can put in a earthwork swell, contour water harvesting ditch, and tree plant that, and you can go around the outside of the pasture and then contour line tree lines through the pasture after doing this earthworks. I realize this is a lot of development, but ecosystems require some attention once they've gone to a disturbed situation where you get things like this weed, what we call a weed, coming in to repair with fast carbon pathways. It's not a problem, really. It's a solution in that you can see that this reaction is a repairing mechanism to bring in particular conditions to the soil and elements to the soil to bring it back towards a more ecosystemic, ecosystem type function. So by design, we look at what's happening. We use a natural sequence and we speed it up by applying what is needed to bring it back to an ecosystem interaction. And we can do that conveniently by the perimeter of the grazing area, which can have forage trees. Actually, feed the animals can graze off as they grow over the fence and also through the pasture, where we can conveniently fence on contour and get a good water harvest to the tree growth and a manure pickup, which will help subsidize the pasture's nutrient deficiencies even when we make a mistake. So it's all about design, but it's bringing that element that we consider a problem into a solution situation by taking it through a fast track of nature, which is really taking the element into a compost cycle and bringing that back in a convenient way to the land and structurally loosening the soil and allowing it to receive both seed and the compost element, which will quickly take it out of that cycle. Now, you might want to, if you can, run over the area with a forage harvester, pick up the as much bulk of the St. John's Wort as you can, and then go again at the end. Of the growth cycle. There you go. So it's that simple, but it is a bit of a process and there is a sequence to it, and you can fast track out of this situation. Anybody can do this by analyzing the responses a natural system has to an unnatural set of behaviors that take it into a sequence of plants that are not normally in the position naturally. So you can take that analysis and move it in a fast track towards the situation you prefer, but you have to balance the natural interaction on from there. There you go.
I mean, I'll just add that good grazing will fix most pasture issues. Grazing itself will start successing you toward grass and forb-based perennials. So everything Jeff said, but on top of it, just the act of grazing properly in rotational movement alone will help a lot. The problem is, I guess, I don't know enough about grazing cattle or any other ruminant that, like, what happens if they're out there and there's so much St. John's Wort that they start living on St. John's Wort. Like, I don't really know that. So, like, a lot of the other stuff Jeff said would be helpful. But you might want to reach out to, like, the Savory Institute on this. I think that Alan Savory's people might be the best equipped to help you with this, given the size of the land that you're working with. Moving on, Let's hear from Nicole Sauce on setting pricing in a business at a time when you're the sole labor force, but long term you might want to be able to draw like a salary from it, and you won't be the only, you'll have to pay somebody. How do we work these numbers out? Nicole, take it away.
Howdy, TSP. Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Hollow Roast Coffee with a question from Matt in Maine. Matt asks, how can I calculate the cost of a product as the sole owner of a business with the hopes of growing? In other words, do I calculate the owner's labor as labor cost or as profit? Matt goes into a lot of detail about his herb business, and what he's doing is harvesting herbs, getting them in a dryer within 12 hours of harvest, and then packaging that into a premium herb product, which is, well, let's just say hands down, way fresher than anything you can get anywhere unless you are also doing something like this. And he's kind of stuck on, he's calculated like how much of his labor is in each jar, and then he's stuck on how to price it, not what it costs him. So I would say this, Matt, you figured out what your cost is when you figured out the cost of the herbs, the jar, and how much time it takes you to package it at a rate that you would pay somebody to package it. That's your cost. If you want to make a profit on it, then you need to price it higher than your cost. And then that profit goes into other parts of the business. Like, you'll have expenses out of it, like marketing and other costs like that and other overhead costs. As well as, if you make enough profit and you do end up running the business as the manager and, you know, you have employees doing things, you're paying your salary out of that, right? So I would say this. How can you craft a really good story about your herb product that helps people connect why they should be spending $10, $15, $20 a bottle or whatever the price point is that you think is what the market should pay for this kind of premium product? How can you craft the story to get people excited to throw their money at you? Because your product, you should not be comparing it to the wrong category. And when you compare your product to the grocery store herb category, that's not your category. Those have been sitting around for God knows how long in God knows what conditions. And yours is very fresh, very freshly dried, grown in a way that's, well, pretty darn awesome and organic. And that's going to mean a couple of things. One, I know this because I grow my herbs. You need less of them to get the same power, flavor profile and things. So people will end up using fewer of your herbs when they buy them because they have a much more powerful flavor. The flavor is a little bit different when herbs are handled right. And, you know, fresh versus dried versus fresh dried, right? Versus freeze dried versus, you know, air dried versus heat dried. All of those things make a huge impact on herbs. And then they're also supporting a local craft business, which is what you are. And all of those things mean that you can command a higher price. So I think I need to throw this question back to you. Well, what can you sell them for? Because that's really the question. And I know this from personal experience and from Jack kicking my own butt over my price for Hollow Roast early on. When you ask the appropriate price for your product, there are people who won't buy it. But the people who do buy it and who understand why your product is so awesome are people you want to be selling to for the rest of your life, and you will be. So keep that in mind. Hope this helps you come to a conclusion on what you should price your product at. I think, you, as I said, you did a great job of figuring out what your cost is. Now what are you going to sell it for? And speaking of premium products, did you know that Jack and I put our heads together on a pretty darn awesome coffee that is available at Hollow Roast Coffee seasonally? That's right. It's Jack's Bourbon Cooled Sumatran Coffee. I've got not very much left. I'm trying to actually source another bag so I can sell more pounds to y'all, but you better get your order in. If you want some, that is over at hollowroast.com. Make it a great week.
So what she was hitting on toward the second part of there is, you know, I have certain things that I have what I call absolute definitions of. That means that that definition can be done in a phrase to at the most a sentence, and once you have that definition, you can fully understand the concept to the point where you don't really, there's plenty more, but you don't really need it. And one of those is the definition of marketing, which is simply telling your story. And viral marketing, right, is getting other people to tell your story. And that's what she's hitting on there about the story behind the product, and I completely agree with that. One thing I have to caution people with, though, when you're setting a labor rate, to really understand what you're doing is there is a minimum number of hours that a person needs to be able to work in any given time period to make it worth them taking a job with you. And this is what I mean. Let's say I have a job and it pays, if I say something stupid, you'll say I'll do it, right? So if I say $1,000 an hour and it's 1 hour a week, you're there. You're signing up. You're making a full-time income working out. Like, I get it. But, you know, most people, to do the type of work we're talking here, if you offered them something like, let's say $20 an hour to do it, to start, that's a pretty good wage. But if I'm going to work 3 hours a week, that's $60. There's a very small number of people willing to do that. So you have to think a little bit differently than just a straight hourly wage. You have to think about two things. One, how much you need to pay a person minimal a week so that they'll show up consistently and do the job. And that's probably in the neighborhood of like 15 to 20 hours. You can probably get a part-time employee in that range where you're worth having, right? Unless you know somebody who, you know, lives next door and they can come over an hour a day, 3 days a week, something like that. And they'll, like, unless you have that, and you can't build a business and scale on that model. So you have to think about the total cost per week, because no employee will ever work by the hour the way that you will for yourself. They will never match your productivity as your business scales. And if you give them work and you give them, let's say, 15, 20 hours a week, they're going to take 15 to 20 hours a week to do the work, just like you do when you have a job. So you have to factor that into it. Then the other side is you have to think about burden labor rate, especially long term. What I'm saying is you always have to push your number higher than you think you do on the labor. Because when you hire somebody, oh, I'm going to hire them as a contractor. Okay, that might work for your first person. It's part-time and you 1099 them and all. And you know, but you still have costs associated with having employees. Trust me, there's a reason I don't have any anymore. So you got to look at what's your burden labor rate. And if you're going to grow your business to where maybe there's four or five of these people, then there's a place for them. There's a cost associated with the overall operations of the business that gets assigned to the worker. We have to either air condition or heat the space that they work in. You know, there will be some level of, you know, matching Social Security. You're not going to be able to keep people like this on contract forever. You're really not, because you're going to expect them to show up at a certain time, leave at a certain time, and tell them how to do their job. Guess what? That means they're not contractors, right? So unless you can figure out a way to outsource it on a fixed cost per unit method, which sounds like with the level of care you're taking, you won't, you need to push whatever you come up with for a number on labor, push that number up at least 10 to 20%, no matter what you do. This is another thing on pricing the product itself. If you are completely comfortable with your price, raise your price. Let me say that one more time. If you're completely comfortable with your price, raise your price. Because we tend to underprice ourselves as entrepreneurs, especially new entrepreneurs. And this is the other fact. You price your product at, let's say, it doesn't even matter because it doesn't, you know, size and quantity and whatever it is. Let's say you price a product at $25 delivered. $25 is what comes out of the customer's pocket. If that makes you a really good margin, let's say you're making $20 profit, it's $5 cost to deliver. That's great. Let's say nobody buys it. You have a lot of room to cut the price, and no one gets pissed when you cut the price. When you say, well, it's $25 a bottle, but right now we have a special for three bottles for $60, nobody gets pissed off. When people inquire about discounts and you say, I don't give a fuck how much you buy, that's how much the price is, they don't like it. Trust me, I know it from our duck business. It doesn't bother me because we have enough customers, I don't care. Okay? But that's the type of thing you're going to deal with. And when somebody like me, and you approach me and you say, I want to do something, and I say, I'm not interested in advertising with you, but I am interested in, let's say, bringing you into like a discount program like MSB. You have to have meat on the bone. To adapt to these market realities. It amazes me when I'll talk to somebody about being a discount partner and they like, I can't do it. Well, then you don't charge enough. Do you advertise? Yeah. Okay, wait. So guaranteed ROI on advertising you can't do, but risk advertising you can. And then you ask them, what's your cost of goods produced? And they'll hem and haw, and they'll tell you something like, well, I don't want to share that information. Because you don't know what the number is, right? You got to know these numbers, and you got to put enough meat there that you can adapt to market realities with them. And by the way, in a business like this, your margin should be high. Your margin should be high. The garbage they sell, a lot of these brands that are just packaged somewhere in Utah on some automated machine, the same shit goes on 20 different brands, right? The margins they're making on that shit are, you know, they're making 5 to 6x their cost. This is a high-margin business. You don't need to be afraid to make a good margin on it. Moving on, let's now talk to Sean Mills about evaluating a off-grid solar-powered system for a house you're buying that's already in place. You didn't build it. How do you know if you need to upgrade it? Is it upgradable? Should you do something else? Is it worth the money they're asking relative to the cost of the property, etc.?
Hey, everybody. It's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead. And today I've got a question from Dylan. Dylan says, question for Sean Mills. What are some key factors to look into on an off-grid homestead in regards to existing power system and ability to grow? Details. My wife and I are looking at purchasing an off-grid homestead in central Montana. We currently own and live in an on-grid property in eastern Montana and would be moving for a career opportunity. It's a 10-acre property, 2,700 square foot house, shop, barn, and a ton of existing infrastructure for animals. Existing system is questionable. It looks like 8 panels, 4 kilowatt inverter, and a construction style generator for backup. Price sounds like it would give me some space to do some reworking on existing off-grid power system and add a 12 kW whole house generator. Is adding wind power in Montana feasible, or would extreme cold make that a bad idea? Would it make more sense to create one strong central system and feed out to the shop, or should the shop have its own? I do metal fabrication, welding, and forging as a hobby. Thanks for your time. Well, first of all, Dylan, this sounds like an awesome property. I don't deal with wind much because it's such a small portion of the United States where the annualized wind resource actually makes a lot of sense. There are some parts of Montana where it does, but I would not be the right person to really give you more information on that, just because literally in nearly a decade of helping people design systems, I've only had two people that were in an area where it made any sense for wind. So it's just not something that I really deal with. 8 panels doesn't tell me very much, you know. Those could be 800 watt panels, or they could be 500 watt panels. 4 kW inverter seems pretty small for a 2,700 square foot house with a shop and barn and all of that stuff. It does sound cool that you've got a big generator. So generally, I would say, you know, in your specific situation, that system might work well for running some lights, for, you know, maybe running your fridge. You did not mention any sort of information on batteries, so I don't know if this is a solar direct with a generator backup or what the case is. But in general, if it's not a system that's designed to run the whole house, your best bet is probably to take that existing system, repurpose it out to maybe the shop or barn, and then utilize, you know, and basically build you a new system from scratch. So some of the stuff you would be looking for in your conversations with the homeowner or through the seller's agent with the homeowner is, you know, how many gallons of gas are they running through to top the battery bank up? Can they give you the last 365 days of generation and usage data? Most inverters these days log that. Even if they don't have one of the newer inverters, but they've got, you know, a decent charge controller, then you can normally pick up a good bit of data, at least on the solar resource. So I would ask for that, you know, just to get an idea of how they're using that power and, you know, what kind of generation they're actually getting. I would imagine in Montana, you're probably heating with some combination of LP or natural gas and wood. And so I would stick with that. I would definitely not try to heat up through a Montana winter with electric. And the same thing for cooking. You know, I would stick to propane or natural gas if you've got that available for cooking, and hot water as well, if you've got that as a resource, just because those are draws that are massive, kind of like they surge up, but they're not used very often. So you have to have enough battery and enough inverter to handle those surges, even though you don't need a whole lot of solar panels to generate what's needed for it over the course of the day. So if there's a way to keep those, you know, heating, cooling, not cooling, but heating, hot water and food, if you can keep those things off the electrical side of the house, those are all good things. And then, you know, probably in Montana, you don't have a very big cooling load. Maybe you have, you know, like one mini split or something like that in a main room. If that room's got a lot of glass on it and gets hot, just to kind of keep the temp knocked down in the middle of summer. But those are the things I would be looking for. If you're on well water, you want to make sure that you've got an inverter that's large enough on the output side to handle the locked rotor amperage of the well, as well as enough batteries to handle that. Because everyone says, oh, I got a 12,000 watt inverter. Well, great. Do you have enough batteries to supply 12,000 watts? You know, you don't want to be pulling 100 amps through every one of your batteries. So if I'm going from, say, 48 volts up to 12,000 watts, that's a significant amount of amperage that I'm pushing through there. And I want to be able to spread that out over a large enough battery bank to where I'm not damaging the components in an individual battery. So, for example, if I'm trying to service something that's got a 12,000 watt, surge, where I think I might actually hit that 12,000 watt number for longer than, say, 1 second, then what I'm probably going to want to do is have at least 12,000 watt hours of battery, if not something closer to like 15 or even 20,000 watt hours of battery, so that I've got enough, you know, different battery terminals to pull that load off, because they're going to share it from an amperage standpoint. I'd like to be pulling that from three or four batteries rather than one or two. As a matter of fact, a lot of times if you've got one battery, it's going to come with 100 amp maximum output. And so at a nominal 50 amp or 50 watt rate, 50 volt rating, times 100 amps, that's only going to be 5,000 watts I can pull out of that battery before it turns itself off. And realistically, I don't want to pull more than half that. I really want to be at like 50 amps max on my output. And you got to remember, as that voltage goes down, as we use the battery, the required amperage to support the same number of watts goes up. So I definitely want to, you know, a big enough battery bank to service those loads. I'd want to get that information from the homeowner. I know when we sold our house in East Tennessee that had a solar system on it, we printed out all of the solar output data and just put it in a folder with all the other information we had on the house, so that they could just get an idea of what it was that they were buying. And unfortunately, I heard from my daughter, who was out visiting a friend out there not too long ago. She drove by the house, and it doesn't look like they're using it there. They just let that all grow up. So in any case, you want the battery bank. In your specific scenario, I would probably just look at moving that small system out. Maybe that powers the lights in your shop and in the barn. And then you have a bigger system that runs the house with enough excess where you can run some lines out to run that big equipment. So that's the answer to your other question. Would I do a smaller dedicated system for something like that? In that specific scenario, I would not, because again, you're gonna have to have a big enough battery bank to handle the big draws when you're doing your metal fabrication. And so it's better to just have one really big battery bank and then run everything through that, versus having two like medium large battery banks, one of which never gets used. All right, guys, we'll keep getting those questions in the jack, and I'll keep getting them answered.
So I'll throw one little addition in here for just about anybody that might find them in a situation. And I'll tell you that I think this situation, with the sheer number of off-grid locations that have been built in the last 10 years, people have gotten more and more into doing this. So sooner or later, many people sell a house that they live in. And eventually, the stoppage on property being sold will correct itself, whether it happens because we have a real estate crash, whether we get reasonable, well, not even reasonable, whether we get low interest rates again, whether there's some sort of, something will unstop the mix. Eventually, property will start trading. So you might find yourself in this situation. And whenever anybody asks me, because I was a mechanic in the military, Jack, I'm looking at, especially if they ask about a diesel, because they know I was a diesel mechanic, you know, this truck, and blah, it's like, okay, well, you know, I can't really evaluate the truck from where I am. So I would tell you that when you're making an investment, the size of a house, and you're going to take a mortgage out, it might be fully worth it to find your local equivalent of a Sean Mills, somebody that's like an independent solar engineer, somebody that does this for a living, even if they have a company where they do installs and all. I'm not asking you to bid on anything. I want to give you a couple $100 for you to take 30 minutes to do a walkthrough of this system and give me an assessment of what it can do for me, what it can't do for me, what it's, you know, here's what I'm looking for. Is there an upgrade path? Is it a replacement path? What is it? What is the longevity? Because one of the things you really need to look at with a lot of these systems is how long has it been there? Because a lot of these systems have components that begin to degrade in performance, batteries first, panels second, over time. And they don't do this uniformly, okay? And what I mean by that is the life expectancy of a system in one particular climate will be longer or shorter than in another. So that might be worth doing. And what I was coming at it from the mechanic standpoint is when I get those questions about a vehicle, and I'm like, well, what are you going to spend on this? And somebody's like $5,000 or something. Okay, you're buying a beater. It is what it is. You know, okay. When somebody says I'm going to spend like $15,000-$20,000 or more on a used vehicle, you can probably go to just about any decent mechanic shop, give them $50 to $100, and they will end-to-end inspect it for you. And that's almost always worth it. Every used vehicle I've ever bought has had that done to it. And it usually costs me about $250. And I can think of three instances in particular where there was something found. And in two, I went back and said, well, do this, and I'll buy the vehicle. And they did. And in one, it was like, here's your car. I took it for a test drive right to the shop. Like, here you go. I don't want it. Well, what can we do? Nothing. All right. Anyway, let's move on. And I have a question that I thought was an interesting one. And it was sent in for an expert council member, but I think I'm probably the best suited to answer this because it's a biochar question. So Kurt sent me a question, and it says, what is the best way to turn large 6 to 10 foot tall brush piles into charcoal for biochar? I have a dozen or so of these massive piles, mostly Osage orange and honey locust. Ugh, thorns, right? For cutting down trees to build new fence on the property line. All of these are at least 6 foot tall, 10 foot wide. Attaches a picture because Proton Mobile doesn't embed. It would be cool if we could submit these questions on Noster. I guess you can always submit questions to me on Noster, but if you do it by email, then you're more likely to get an answer like you are right here, because I absolutely check my email for anything with TSPC in the subject line every single day. All right, so I'm looking at the picture he sent, and what it appears to show, and I can't be sure that it does, but what I think it shows is that these trees that were cut down, maybe he was taking the trunks, and Osage orange and locust, while I went, ugh, thorns, are both fantastic woods for longevity. And so these piles look like they are almost 100% slash. So material down to, you know, way smaller than a pinky twig size up to about a wrist. Which means, size-wise, this is ideal for biochar. Reality is, piles of slash, in the words of Ben Falk, are a pain in the ass. And this is why the majority of people that are in this situation simply burn these piles to ash to get rid of them. Because they are low-value waste, and they twist and tangle. And I've got one of these right now because a friend of mine was running an excavator for me, pushed it all into a big pile, and put it, what I consider, too close to my duck coop to be safe for me to burn it. And so I am dealing with this on a much smaller scale than you are right now. Now, how do we do this? Okay, it would have helped if you would have told me because a piece of land this size, it's probable or possible that you have access to some type of heavy equipment, like a backhoe or a mini excavator or a bobcat or God knows what else. Okay. So if you have that, one of the beautiful things that you can do with anything with kind of a digger on it, like a backhoe or an excavator, is with a bucket, especially as this stuff ages and gets brittle, because if you try to, it's funny the way that they put safety into these. Like, you could totally take somebody's foot off with one, but breaking shit and smashing shit's kind of hard. Like, you push down, and like you can only get so much force pushing straight down with a bucket. But as it gets brittle, as you do that, you instead of getting a spring response, it cracks and breaks. So you could actually, if you have any kind of a piece of equipment that will do that, break it up a bit. Even if you have to let it age and dry, because dry is good when we want to make char. And that could help with all of the things that I'm going to talk about doing. So let's talk about ways this could be done. One, when I look at this pile that you sent me, it's right up against a standing tree that looks either dead or dormant that could easily be set on fire. And this happens all the time when we make brush piles, because people make the brush pile and put it out of the way, which is usually up against the edge of a property line, which is where all the trees are. So if you're going to do the first option, which is just burn it, but I'm going to tell you how to burn it, you're probably going to have to move it. Now, if you have a piece of equipment, even a bobcat with just a bucket, you can push this thing the hell away from those other trees and not cause a forest fire. Okay? Because your easiest thing you could do, and you're going to get a low yield, but you will definitely get biochar with this, is to kind of get it into a controlled situation away from those other trees and simply top light burn it. Don't burn it from the bottom, burn it from the top, and let it burn from the top down. Watch it, which you're going to have to do anyway. And I don't know, you know, burn regulations. You have to notify fire department of all this shit, right? That's up to you. And have water on standby. And when it starts to look like it's pretty much done, you can wet it down. And what that's going to do, you're going to have a lot of charcoal left at that point. Some fully pyrolyzed, some not. But then you can at least sort through that and take other means, and we'll talk about that in a second. That would be one option. It's probably the least preferable option, but it might be the most doable one, so I wanted to give it to you first, because this can be done to create charcoal. Okay. The next option, you have equipment, if you're willing to do it, and you have a place to do it, and you can push the stuff in, is to dig a long pit with sloped sides. So I would look at something in the neighborhood of about 10 foot long, at least a couple feet deep. And your long sides, you want to create a little bit of an incline to them. Push your dirt aside. You can fill it back in later. Push your brush piles into those pits and do open pit burns. Again, lit from the top. You'll get a better yield. You'll have to pull the charcoal out of the pit when you're done. You will have to extinguish it to shut down the burn. Okay, and that will work better. That would be the next option. What if you don't have any equipment? Hell, if you can keep the whole place from burning down, obviously, this is another thing you need to realize. When you look at brush piles like this, that's all this fine twiggy shit, it's not as much material as it looks like. Like, is it really worth it just for the biochar? So you're going to have to make a decision, because you might just burn the shit and be done with it and get rid of it. I hate saying that, but it might be your best option. Another option, though, you know, if you're going to continue to have material like this, then you might want to look at something like the Ring of Fire from Kelpie Wilson, or a Contiki cone kiln. These are just, the Contiki is just a big version of the little, you know, perfect biochar, best biochar kiln that I own, that's made out of like thin metal that can be shipped in a box and all. The Contiki is much bigger, but it's a cone kiln. The Ring of Fire is just a ring that's made out of steel, and then an outer ring that's made out of galvanized. Galvanized, we're all going to die. You don't heat galvanized. No, you don't heat galvanized. The galvanized ring is to keep costs down. It goes around the steel ring. Everything burns on the steel ring. Since it's such a big ring, Kelby put the galvanized ring on the outside to keep you from burning yourself. It's a heat guard. It's not even really contributing to the process. It's to be safe. They're both expensive solutions, though, Ring of Fire and the Contiki. But if you're going to, like, if this is a big property, you're going to be doing this a lot, etc., then you may wish to invest in something like that. Okay, now we're going to get to the part that kind of sucks, but it's the cheap way, and it will work. Get yourself a good electronic pruner set like the DeWalt, right? If you're a DeWalt guy, see what your manufacturer has, or get something that's third, you know, like aftermarket product if you don't have a cordless system that has them, and start cutting shit up. Get yourself a wheelbarrow, a trailer behind a lawnmower or whatever, because this is what I do, and start cutting shit up. And then you can burn it in any kiln you want. But probably the most efficient and cheap way to get this stuff into biochar, and it'll take time, and so just do it at your leisure when it works. Cut material till you have enough material and then do a burn. Is just plain old 55-gallon drums. You can do what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be building one. Hopefully it'll be here and operational for the workshop, where you lay the drum on its side, you cut a saddle out of it, and you burn from the side. But honest to God, you can make biochar in nothing but a 50-gallon drum standing up vertical. The beauty of both of those is larger material can fit in them. And you can look up on YouTube how to use them for charcoal burns. And what you can do when you're doing a burn like that is it's often the case that like you can spend a day and end up with a 55-gallon drum of char. And by the way, I know they look huge to you, but looking at those burn piles, it's likely that one of those piles won't even make a full 55-gallon drum of char when it's all said and done with. You're going to reduce weight by a third, but most of the volume in that pile, and I don't mean it in a metaphysical way, like atoms are more space than they are matter. I mean in like reality, like air in between all that bushy shit. Most of that pile, it is air. It's not actually as much material as you think it is. So it might be about 10 barrels you would end up, and I think you might end up with more like 5 full 55-gallon barrels. The beauty of using a 55-gallon barrel just vertically set there, you haven't altered it. You can do something else with it later. You don't have to turn it into a special kiln or anything. The bad news is you have to sit there with it and manage it. But let's say you run about 5 hours of burn, and your top looks good, it's ready to be quenched, but you still have a lot of space, you just quench it. You just quench it. And you're done. And then you can take that char, do something with it, and go back and do it again. So you don't have to fill the barrel. But if you have like a long Saturday, you're drinking beer, hanging out with the kids, throwing the football around, you could just keep adding to that until it's damn near a 55-gallon drum of char. And this material will make great char. So those are like the different ways you can come at this. I don't have a perfect answer because it's not an ideal situation. Like if I was commercially making char, what I'm going to want to do is find a waste stream that's already in an ideal form or very easily converted to an ideal form for making char. So if I was doing it with 55-gallon drums and I could find a cabinet shop, but that material comes on a pallet in the back of my truck and it's 8 foot long on average, I don't care. It's too long, but right down the middle with a saw or maybe into thirds and in it goes, right? If I'm using a large retort, like a 10-yard retort like Bob Wells does, I just throw the whole shit in there, right? So, but one way or another, I'm going to want material, like if I'm going to be doing this on an ongoing basis, that's somehow in a better situation. Helping yourself in the future with that knowledge. We all clear brush. We all do this. We all make these piles. The easiest time to deal with material is when you're getting it off the tree. And what I mean by that is, let's say we drop this tree. I have a lot of locusts. I drop locusts all the time. And you got all that slash. If you go through with like electronic pruners and take all the prunable stuff and at least cut it into, you know, a couple foot long and the main spongy shit, knock it off and throw it into a pile that's more like a organized pile than one of these messes, when you go to take care of it, it will be much easier. And it really doesn't take that much longer to do if you do it that way. Because what usually happens is we drop the tree, right, and we deslash. We just take that saw and we take all of the side branches off that are too small to deal with. We cut the bole wood either in the fence posts or fire or whatever, and we push all that shit in a pile, and then we go, shit, this sucks. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. So maybe a little bit more pre-planning. So those are the different ways. But I know that specifically, Kelpie Wilson is a very active in the world of biochar, and this is what she does for a living. And I know two people who have worked directly with Kelpie and purchased Ring of Fires. Now, One of them that springs to mind runs a blueberry farm. And they have massive prunings. Like what you have is nothing compared to just their prunings every year. And they're now making biochar using one of Kelpie's Ring of Fire kilns and reapplying it to their blueberry orchard. Now, the thing about that is they're a commercial operation. It's just a piece of equipment. It's a few thousand dollars. They can justify that as a farm expense. You sound like a private landowner, so it may not work for you. But I just wanted to give you those, you know, all the options you have, because those are the options. But I would go no smaller with your kiln than like an open 55-gallon kiln for this, and that would be cheap. How cheap? So J.R. Haley's bringing me a couple barrels because it was easy for him to get them around where he lives for the workshop that we're going to try to make one into a side kiln for you. $15 a piece. And they look brand new. They're not brand new, but they look brand new. $15. And I see them all the time, $15 to $25. You know, and the thing is, if you don't mind doing the work to prep the material, you could have four or five of these running at once. You could go through a ton. It's not really more work as long as you have the material sized and ready to go into these bins. It's not really much work to run three than it is to run one. It's because it's not a lot of work. It's just you have to pay attention. And as your top layer begins to ash, that's when you need to add your next layer. And then the beauty of this is you could just have like a beer party. Get four or five 55-gallon drums, get some beers in a cooler, get some music playing, have a bunch of friends over, hand out cutting implements, and just keep tossing shit in, guys. Keep tossing it in. Maybe do one burn yourself first to get experience, because it takes a little bit of self-training to know when to add, why there's so much smoke. And again, if you do it that way, unless you're doing the side saddle method, if you're doing just the vertical can method, you do nothing to the drum. You do nothing to the drum. You just take the lid off and stand it upright. You can also put it on about a 60-degree angle. That works really well, too. And then there is one mod you can make to drums like this if you want your life to be a little bit easier getting started. What you can do is put some holes in the bottom of the drum. Oh, no, it won't be charcoal. Calm, relax. Not you, the guy to ask the question, but the audience as a whole. And then put a couple bricks under the drum just enough to lift it a couple inches off the ground. Once your initial fire's going good in the bottom and you're beginning to add material, take a shovel and knock the bricks out. That way you have this hot bed of coals to off-gas your next layer of material and it'll run much better for you. Anyway, I will have the next course coming out. Will be on biochar and it will go in-depth into all this stuff. With that, hope you enjoyed today's show. If you did, remember you can help us out by doing your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Don't have a new item of the day for you today, but I do have several that we put out this week that I want to remind you of that will all go out in the Daily Mail today as well. First up, Vivor has their galvanized raised garden beds on sale again today. These are 4-foot by 8-foot beds. The 2-foot deep ones are on sale for $80. Plus, you get 5% more off with my discount code. You cannot even get close to building a 2-foot deep 4x8 garden bed using pressure treated lumber for $80. The 1-foot depth beds are also probably better for most of you because your biggest expense is going to be fill. And unless you want the higher beds, the 1 foot of depth will work for you guys really, really well. I think they're on sale for like $60. So they're both available in my write-up. So the Vivor garden beds, it's a bit late to plant your fall garden, but it's not a bit too late to get those beds in and planning for overwintering, maybe winter gardening in some climates with some protection, or just getting things ready in advance for next spring, because that will be here before you know it. Ciantech remote control light switch kit is also an item of the day this week. Those are on sale as well. They're under $25. You get five outlets that you can plug in and a remote control number 1 through 5 on and off. It's that simple. You plug something in, you press 1, it comes on. You press the 1 off side, it goes off. I use these a bunch in a bunch of different ways on my property, including running the mood lights in my shop that we use for the workshop, some of my studio lights, and, of course, Dorothy's Christmas Forest. So I'll let you know about that. And then Anker is my favorite electronics brand. And all this week they have had a ton of stuff on really great markdown deals. So I don't have individual products. I have a post that's, that notes about five specific products, but they have about 100 products on really deep discounts. Now, some are off like 20%. Some of the stuff's off 40, 60%. Anker is the best value brand, electronics brand I have ever found. When I first started recommending them, it was about 10 years ago. That's how long it's been. And they were pretty much exclusively available on Amazon. They're now available at Costco, a lot of other retailers. They've hit the big time, but they've kept that solid value proposition, that price-to-value recommendation. If you're looking for anything electronic, you know, like Bluetooth speakers, chargers, and stuff like that, always check the Anker option first. What you'll often find is they'll be much less expensive than like an Apple or a Bose, a little bit more expensive from some weird Chinese brand you've never heard of, and 1,000 times better than those, and almost as good as the really expensive ones. And this is the big thing about Anker. There's a 99% chance you will have no problem with anything you buy from them. There's also, if you have the 1% where you do have a problem, something went wrong, you get a lemon, whatever, there's a 100% chance that Anker will fix it. That is the beauty of Anker. With that, hope you guys enjoyed today's show. Tomorrow we'll have a Friday flashback. Next week we'll do it all over again, regularly scheduled type programming. And then the following week we're going to have, again, the workshop that week. So I will have no new shows, not this coming week, but the following week. But what you should know is beginning Thursday the following week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, we will be broadcasting live all of the presentations from the workshop on the TSP YouTube channel. If you're not already subscribed to our YouTube channel, you should do that. Click the little alert bell so that you get that. Yes, we love all the alternative platforms. There's a lot of moving parts when we're doing this at a workshop. The one source that we can 100% know will work all the time is YouTube. And then my alternative sources like Rumble and Odyssey, we'll just import the video for long-term keeping, let's say. So that's what we'll be doing. And the beauty of YouTube is also we have real-time feedback there. So if you're watching one of those presentations live, you can use the chat feature and you can ask questions and participate from wherever you are in TSP 24. With that, have a great Friday tomorrow and a great weekend. And if you're taking your kids out trick-or-treating tonight, have a great and safe evening and a hell of a lot of fun. And, you know, I'm hard on people eating lots of sugar and shit. Halloween's once a year. Go out, enjoy it. Just don't eat too much candy corn or it'll make you sick. Run you round.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. Better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Revolution.